different. You go off to different groups, Jim. But we have your back, and Jim is going to be sharing tonight. It was great to have you here, Jim. And Rob has been drooling over this one. A new light on old stories. It's going to be presented by Jim Worley of A History Only, and Jim is going to tell us more about how writing the big book has affected him or influenced him. Jim.
Thank you, David. And thanks for inviting me back. I always enjoy being here. This is like my home. I like the set aside prayer, everything I think I know, and keeping an open mind. That certainly has to do with our topic this month of the writing the big book. Anyway, my name is Jim Worley, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 5th, 1989. My home group is the First Things First group in Cancun, Mexico. And I've talked before about writing the big book and the differences and some things. And, in this corner, we have Bill W. with his story. And in the other corner, we have Bill S. with history. And this presentation's a little bit different. But to start off, one thing is to research and write one of the most well-documented and detailed histories of the making of the basic text of AA and make it a lively and interesting read. It's quite another to write a book that affects people's lives and ways of thinking, and in our case, a book that in addition adds to and enriches the recovery of so many of us who have read it over the years in our meetings and shared. But this time I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to play a little tongue-in-cheek devil's advocate and even talk about things that might have affected me and some other even criticisms of writing the big book and things that disturbed some people as they came up. And so anyway, this is titled Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA, A New Light on Old Stories. These are just some of my thoughts on the book and a look at history and story and learning and why we don't always like new lights put onto our old stories. So what is history? History attempts to describe and explain the past. Historians are generally concerned with the causes, consequences, and significance of events. History is distinct from myths and narratives about the past in that history is exclusively concerned with what can be demonstrated through the reasoned use of evidence. So it's not just evidence, but it's the reasoned use of evidence. History is a moving target of story. That means that our understanding of historical events is not fixed, but constantly evolves as new information, perspectives, and interpretations come to light, making the truth of the past a dynamic and shifting concept, much like trying to hit a moving target. Bernie Kurtz says that history is important because story is important, and few existing entities better demonstrate or more deeply realize the importance of story than the Storytelling Program and Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. History is important because, in those thematic words, those who have no memory have no hope. There's a link between memory and hope. Both are fragile, and so each sustains the other, and each needs all the help it can get from the other. This is why the real story of Alcoholics Anonymous is important. We need hope, and our hope is founded in memory. And because memory is fallible and easily deceived, we need the archives that house and make available the necessary checks to errant memory. Now, this is one of the first quotes that I ever remember actually memorizing from writing the big book. I think it's on page 7 or 8. And I just like this. Memory frequently remembers what the present wants to hear, you know, whether it's this story or my own story when I tell it. I tell it from the present that I'm in right now. Again, Ernie Kurtz goes on to say the story and storytelling lie at the very heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA's basic text and voices within meetings across the globe disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. From the catalytic meeting between two desperate men in the mid-1930s to today's growing varieties of AA experience, the history of AA is a story about stories and the healing power of mutual storytelling. Anyone wishing to truly understand AA must look first, not to ideas, techniques, or studies, but to stories. And that's what we look at today. Our basic text, Alcoholics Anonymous, is a story. That's what it tells us on the title page. It is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And what do we do with our stories? And we're told to pass it on. And how do we pass it on? One to another, sharing our experience, strength, and hope, telling one person or many people, and passing it on from one to another. Well, the problem with passing it on, this picture looks like a group of stoners watching one of my traditions hit workshops. But anyway, have you heard about the telephone game, you know, where one person whispers something to someone and they pass it to the next person and they pass it on. And by the time it gets to the other end, it's completely different. Well, imagine the telephone game played for 89 years. And the fact that some of us are here because we're not all there also occasionally affects our passing it on ability. And we're also getting not just one person telling us things, but lots of people nowadays, especially with the internet and Zoom, a lot of people telling us a lot of things. Arthur S. Says that AA members seem to have a warm place in their heart for history. The AA Fellowship also has a strong verbal tradition. Much information is passed on by word of mouth. This has both its good and difficult sides. Begs the question, how much narrative is fact and how much is myth or error? History is not supposed to be statements of beliefs. It is supposed to be statements of facts. Much anecdotal myth circulates in AA and is erroneously accepted as fact. Myths, unfortunately, assume the aura of facts when frequently repeated. Inaccurate statements such as Dr. Bob sobered up on June 10th or no changes have been made to the wording of the big book text permeate AA. The popular adage that repetition strengthens and confirms certainly applies to practicing AA principles. Unfortunately, also applies to making myths and errors appear to be facts. And, you know, as stories get passed along, you know, from one to another and over the years, sometimes what is originally said is not what is heard at the end of the line. Well, I mean, this is one that I've used. Bill Wilson told us how the big book was written. You know, this is a great, it's transcribed on the internet, it's everywhere. And he talked about it in Fort Worth in June of 1954. From start to finish, how the big book was written and how it all came about. And so, you know, we've got Bill's. And, well, he started out by saying he was going to tell a yarn. Now, for those who don't knit, yarn has another meaning. And the OD, not our OD, of course, but from Boston, but the Oxford Dictionary says that a yarn is a long or rambling story, especially one that is implausible. And this is from the Oxford Dictionary, could easily apply to Bill. He never let reality get in the way of a good yarn. Bill starts out his story about the big book with, I would just like to spin some yarn. And there'll be a series of yarns which cluster around the preparation of the good old AA Bible. And when I hear that, it always makes me shudder because the guys who put it together weren't a damn bit biblical. I think sometimes some of the drunks have an idea that these old timers went around with almost visible halos and long gowns, and they were full of sweetness and light. Oh boy, how inspired they were. Oh yes, but wait till I tell you. And that's how Bill started out his story. I also learned a lot of history from Joe and Charlie. You know, they talked about history and what Bill meant and what he was talking about. And we need to go back and look at the history, Joe and Charlie said. Anybody else still got their cassettes? I don't have a cassette player anymore, but I still have my Joe and Charlie on cassette. So I learned a lot from Bill and Joe and Charlie. And And then came along this flyer back in 2019, An Afternoon with the Authors. Gary Neidhart with King Charles of New York. I understand there's a second edition coming out soon. Drunks with Chris, by Chris Winnan, and this new book, Writing the Big Book. And there was going to be a book launch up there in Ridgewood, New Jersey on Saturday, November 16th, 2019, from 2 to 6. Well, that sounds like fun. I'm going to fly up there from Cancun. And it was a great weekend. You know, besides the book launch, I got a personalized tour around New Jersey, the New Jersey AA Landmarks by our friend up there who is all things AA New Jersey, and also got to go to Stepping Stones and that great experience. But I mainly went up there to get this new book and see what it was all about, this Writing the Big Book, the Creation of AA, that I'd been hearing about. Well, the book starts out, in fact, it starts and I think it ends with a quote from an interview Bill did with Dorothy Snyder, Clarence Snyder's wife, where she says, well, this is switching back, but one of the things I feel vitally important is to get the story of how the book was actually written. We get so many distorted stories on the West Coast. This was in the 50s, and already they're distorted. People talk about the 100 men that wrote the book. Actually, there weren't 100, as Bill will bear me out. But he said 100 to make it sound good, as though it really was going to work. People talk as though there were 100 men. They all went saintly and were taken straight up to heaven. And God just guided Bill's hands. And Bill just sat there and let the words come through. Actually, it wasn't anything like that at all. Well, you know, some of this is new information, and we have a tendency to. We're actually hardwired to resist change. Part of the brain, the amygdala, interprets change as a threat and releases the hormones for fear, fight, or flight. Your body is actually protecting you from change. Well, that's good, because I know how the Big Book was written. I read Bill Wilson, I heard his talk, and Joe and Charlie told me. And now this: when faced with change, our existing beliefs and habits are challenged, creating a sense of internal discord. As humans, we're naturally inclined to seek consistency and stability, and any disruption to this equilibrium can trigger feelings of anxiety and resistance. So the book didn't wait around and do things politically. It just let's rip the Band-Aid right off in chapter one, challenging the creation myth. And so, you know, when I got home, I just started reading that book and couldn't until I finished. You know, it was fascinating to me. My retention, I don't know, but I read it. It was fascinating. And but this one about the creation myths, this is all new. While these real-time documents provide the most unassailable evidence of what happened in AA between 34 and 39, that history is further embellished by the later writings and statements of four early participants in the story: Bill, Abby, Jim Burwell, and Ruth Hock. The word embellished is used here deliberately to emphasize the fact that each of these four eyewitnesses has proven to be unreliable to one degree or another once their testimony is critically compared with the available. Oh, well, all right. This should not be surprising. At best, memory is a defective and self-deceptive faculty. Well, yeah, okay. You know, the paragraph, this frequent lack of accuracy is found out not only among these four more prominent narrators, but also in later recollections of early AA members. This isn't meant to impugn everything that was said. You know, this was challenging the creation myth. And I think we read it all together, what, David, six times, I think. And from 2020 to 2024, and we got together and read it, and you know, I know that the last time, I think we had over 100 people when we started off, and I wonder how many we lost after this chapter. There's a lot of things in there that make me question what I had already heard before. Now, if we read, and you can go on to Amazon and you can read page after page after page of good, great reviews about writing the big book, The Creation of AA. You know, here are just some of them. You know, one of the most influential books of our times, an eye-opening experience, impeccable research. A guy by the name of Hugh H. said that he felt that God, not God by Ernie, was the most accurate and substantiated history of AA. But now the honor goes to writing the big book. Well, I have an open mind, but trouble with having an open mind is that people will insist on coming along and trying to put things into it. And as David noticed, that is a recent picture of me, and I'm going for the Bob Hickey distinguished outdoor woodsman look, but right now I'm at the grungy homeless wino stage, but we'll see how the beard grows. Some of the other, since I'm playing devil's advocate, I'm going to look at some of the other, very few, by the way, negative attitudes or reviews. It depends on how interested you're in history. Somebody says the level of detail was just overwhelming for me as a beginner, as a neophyte. Some people state that the author had too many unsubstantiated conclusions. You know, well, okay. Somebody said, I don't like searching around, going up and down and looking for endnotes and footnotes. And I don't get the point of writing about this. Sounds like he's angry, or maybe he couldn't get sober. Well, 40, how many years, Bill? Anyway, you know, I don't like what you said, so, you know, I don't like you. Somebody just said didn't like. Yeah, well, okay, that's about as plain as you can be. I don't know what art is, but I know what I like. I just didn't like it. The book was disappointing. Dick B. has written a whole lot with greater depth and more accurately. Okay. This person says, being a writer and historian myself, oh, boy, there's a definite disadvantage. So it's an entertaining read, but little else. Somebody else says, if you really want to know about the big book, read What is the Oxford Group? Because writing the big book has nothing new under the sun. This one really got to me. Well, it may be factual, but it's still confusing and disturbing. Yeah, to me too sometimes. I read part of the book and stopped because I found it personally disturbing. It's not helping me to stay sober. It's kind of a criminal investigation, and I will stay far from it because I want to stay sober. Somebody said that he stated things that are opinion and not fact. And I don't think you, so I don't like you. So you must not be an alcoholic. And anyone, stay away from it, you know, if you want to stay sober. He still didn't convince me that Hank wrote to employers, even with all his documentation. The book is too huge. A good editor would have knocked it down to less than half its length. Endless unabbreviated letters and early versions of the 12 steps. I'll be taking the book back to the library. I later learned that, of course, Bill's policy was to, I found this. I might as well include it. You know, let's include it. Let's just not leave it out. Anyway, except for the parts about could have been this, could have been that, it was a wonderful book. And then another one-star review was, I believe God spoke through Bill. End of story for me. Now, although he doesn't specify whether God was speaking through Bill Wilson or Bill Schaberg, I think we can probably conclude that he was talking about Bill Wilson. But we're connecting dots here. It wasn't specific. I mean, I have an open mind. I love learning new things. Well, I love learning new things that I like learning. Sometimes I hate learning new things. A person may well dislike learning new ideas that contradict old notions with which they've become comfortable. So comfortable, in fact, that those familiar ideas are seen as a part of their identity, of who they are. The new idea can seem like a direct personal attack. Listen, I've been telling this story about that Bill told about the writing the big book. I've been telling that for years, as if it were gospel. And now there's some doubt about it. There's something called belief perseverance. That's the tendency to hold on to initial beliefs even after receiving new information that contradicts them. Confirmation bias leads people to favor information that confirms their existing beliefs. We'll get into some more of my confirmation bias here later. But here's a little on my journey to competence. You know, I started off as a novice, you know, very quickly. You know, I'm a good study. I became an expert pretty quickly in my study of AA history, and then of course a mega expert. And didn't take very long because I was a before I was a mega supreme oracle of expertise in everything that I studied. Then this Aristotle guy kept whispering, you know, the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know. So, well, okay, maybe I'm somewhere in between novice and intermediate, you know, but I'm still learning. But there are some things I don't know. But there's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's a type of cognitive bias where people with little expertise or ability assume they have superior expertise or ability. This overestimation occurs as a result of the fact that they don't have enough knowledge to know that they don't have enough knowledge. Well, that could have been me at one point. The greatest obstacle to knowledge is not ignorance, it's the illusion of knowledge. The idea is simple but counterintuitive. In learning any new domain, our confidence is actually highest when we start. This is surprising because rationally we should have the lowest confidence when we know the least. However, Dunning and Kruger found that when we don't know what we don't know, we overestimate our abilities. So the lesson, no matter how much we know, we only know a fraction of all there is to know. We must assume our own ignorance. An attitude of caution can help us avoid developing false beliefs that can lead to irrational decisions. And collecting the dots, the information, is not the same as connecting the dots, but both are the job of the historian. And historians interpret information from a primary source to draw conclusions or make inferences. An inference is choosing the most likely explanation for the facts at hand. You know, otherwise, a history book would just be copies of old letters and things in archives. You know, there has to be some kind of interpretation of the data and inference and conclusions made. Just like the old kids' puzzle books that are the origin of this metaphor of connecting dots, you probably had some. You know, you start off with something, it doesn't really look like anything, and the outline becomes an image, and then pretty soon you have enough dots and you even complex. Most important question, of course, is what do you do with the dots? It's not just collecting the information, but what do you do with the dots? And you know, human beings have what they call pattern recognition. You know, we see, you know, houses and angels and spaceships and all kinds of things in the clouds. You know, we see what we recognize through our own experience and education. I may get this free sample and I think, well, this looks, I think I know what that is. This ought to be a fun connect your dots thing. And you know, then I connect some more, I get some more information and some more dots, and now I'm pretty sure I've got that. And so I start connecting the dots and you know, okay, well, now I think I'm pretty good at this. Now, of course, the historian actually wants to know, were those brass buttons or ivory, and what, you know, what material was the coat made out of? And a lot of things we'll never know, but at least we come to some conclusions by connecting the dots. The problem with connecting the dots is that different people will connect the same dots in different ways. The guy who builds houses may think it looks like connected by looking like a house. Someday, some guy who's trying to make his way to Mars may think it looks like a rough version of a spaceship, you know, and they're all the same dots. You know, I have no idea how these people think that there's a lion and an archer and a bear and all the, how will they connect dots? You know, I will, you know, I don't know. Some of the dots that I connected and found interesting, eye-opening, and thought-provoking in writing the big book, where the was the creation myth, the Akron, and writing the big book. Hank's contribution, the co-founder question, who wrote the big book, the six-step myth, four steps, outside editors, the non-AAs, and religious to spiritual Fitz's story and the kitchen table. These were just some of the things that drew my attention. Bill Wilson is a consummate storyteller. The primary revelation of this kind of critical research and investigation. By the way, this is all from writing the big book, and also from later on, we'll see some of Bill's presentations that I have that I plagiarize, that I quote and copy. But anyway, the investigation, the man who contributed more quote unquote factual information than anyone else was by far the worst offender when it came to accuracy regarding early history. This may sound harsh to Wilson's many worshipful admirers in the fellowship, but it's an undeniable fact, as will be shown in the pages to follow. Bill was a consummate storyteller, and his stories were almost always liberal simplifications of the facts. Abby Thatcher's visit, a prime example of Wilson's creative myth-making, can be seen in his version of an encounter considered to be one of the pivotal moments in AA history. Somewhere between one-third and one-fifth of Bill's story in the big book is about Abby Thatcher's visit at the kitchen table, where Bill sat on one side. Abby called him up. Bill answered the phone, said, "Come on over." Bill answered the door. They sat at the kitchen table and talked. Well, Abby Thatcher, the man who supposedly sat on the other side of the kitchen table, told a completely different story. He said, there at the bottom, "So I called him up one night, and I didn't get Bill, but I got Lois, his wife, and told her what happened to me. And Lois said, 'Why don't you come over?' And she mentioned a date, and I said, 'Fine.' So that night I went over, and Mr. Green answered the door, and because the Wilsons weren't there. And then pretty soon Bill appeared, and then they sat down for dinner, and another girl was invited, and the story is completely different." Abby told his version of that evening in Brooklyn on several different occasions, always acknowledging that the story you read in the big book is a little different. He once glibly explained those differences by noting that, after all, he happened to be sober that night while Bill Wilson was drunk, pointing out that there were some details of that talk that Bill doesn't remember. What? You know, I sat at that kitchen table. You know, I'm invested in this story. It's a story that I've been hearing ever since I got sober. You know, one alcoholic talking to another sitting at a kitchen table. And, you know, I've heard that history should make you uncomfortable. And some of this stuff makes me uncomfortable sometimes. Moore says that there are three levels of resistance to change. First, I don't get it. Why are you doing this to me? The other is, I don't like it. And of course, the third is, I don't like you for saying it, you know. So, and let's get Bill. Bill goes on telling his yarn about the big book, and he says, "I suppose the book yarn really started in the living room of Doc and Annie. We counted noses. We had 35, 40 people sober. And how are we going to pass this message on to others who don't know it? And we need hospitals and drunk tanks." And the group conscience consisted of 18 men, good and true. And the good and true men, you could see right away, were damn skeptical about it all. But Bill Wilson, you know, comes to the rescue, and despite all their arguments, convinces them, and they have a vote, and they win. Bill wins by two votes, you know. And so let me go back to writing the big book again. Writing the big book says almost all the particulars in Bill's version of that October 1937 meeting are contradicted by contemporary documents. He and Lois didn't go alone. He didn't go alone. Lois went, and they were accompanied by two other couples, the Parkers and the Riddells. And, you know, there are a lot of details left out. So here's this story that I've been telling other people and myself. But again, I'm being told that, well, maybe this isn't true. Such is the collected substance of Bill's several colorful accounts regarding the AA vote and AA's momentous decision to write a book. Down at the bottom there, it says, the problem is that many of the details reported in this story are simply not true. Even more important, Bill leaves out a host of important facts and critical factors that are essential for any understanding of what really happened that night in Akron. Okay, you know, I'm open-minded, you know, but sure, the explanation for discrepancies in these stories lie with Bill himself. If this is so, it reveals an endearing, must be conference approved literature that says that, this is from back, pass it on, an endearing and important facet of Bill's character. Second paragraph, Bill was never likely to pass up the opportunity to deliver a parable where he thought it could do some good, never afraid to use himself as a negative example when he thought he could make a point, never reluctant to stretch a fact for the sake of emphasis. So, okay, yeah, Bill. Remains a matter of speculation in that story about the voting, whether the New York ringers, Fitz and Sterling and Bill Riddell, whether they voted or not in that very narrow approval of Bill's grand schemes of things. We just don't know. This was from an interview with Bob Kay that Bill Schaeberg did some years ago. Schaeberg draws us to some additional mystery. All the diaries that Lois left are intact, except for the one from 1937, which has 70 pages removed. The excised pages include the days of the Akron trip. Oh, well, this is something I can sink my teeth in now. I love conspiracy theories. I got to figure out that, you know, who tore out those pages and where are they? And did the dog eat the homework, or did the Stepping Stones people or GSO? Where are those missing pages? You know, that I can get into. The original four steps, I had read Bill's original story, the long version, many times, but I never really heard this or got this, that there were, you know, the four steps in his original story that he told. Step one was to turn my face to God as I understand him and say to him with earnestness, complete honesty and abandon, that I henceforth place my life at his disposal and direction forever. Step two, having taken this step, I should prepare myself for God's company by taking a thorough and ruthless inventory. Step number three required I carefully go over my inventory and definitely arrive at the conclusion that I was now willing to rid myself of these defects. And step number four demanded that I frankly admit that my deviations from right thought and action had injured other people. Therefore, I must set about undoing the damage to the best of my ability. All four steps. I'd heard the stories of the six steps. Well, maybe that'll come in later. Then I think something that surprised a lot of people was a lot of the information we learned about Bill's right-hand man, Hank Parkhurst, the forgotten man of early AA history, and how influential that he was in the writing, marketing, and publication of the Big Book. From 36 to 39, Hank acted as Bill's right-hand man in the New York Fellowship. Bill often referred to him as my partner in the book enterprise. Next paragraph there, Hank played an absolutely central role during the critical months between October 37 and April 39, making repeated and substantial contributions in the direction to which the fellowship and the books were developing. So a lot of information there. Hank had a lot to do with this, a lot more than what I had heard before. A lot of new information. So then there's it. Hank names the book, the group, and the foundation. Okay, so finally we get to the answer. Who came up with the name Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, right there, it says Hank names the book. Okay, so, well, we found out that it wasn't Joe Warden, as the old stories said. He didn't join until after the name had already been in use. And but as Hank was proposing the phrase as the name of the group, the title of the book, and the name of their new publishing company, Foundation, Bill also used it in the first draft of There Is a Solution as the group's name. We of Alcoholics Anonymous now know at least 100 men. Shortly after that, he wrote to Dr. Bob that Alcoholics Anonymous was the name nearly everyone agrees should be used. So since Bill's notes were sketched while Bill was still dictating, it is impossible to know whether he was borrowing from Bill or if Bill had inserted the phrase into the new chapter after reading Hank's notes. So now, was it Hank or was it Bill? I thought they said Hank, so it must be Hank. Well, you know, there I go connecting dots that really aren't there. And another case of that was, why don't you choose your own conception of God? You know, all I had to see was, wow, Hank Parkhurst's handwriting had these four little paragraphs that are so crucial to early AA and to many people since. This idea of why don't you choose your own conception of God were written in the manuscript in Hank's handwriting. So Hank actually wrote these. Well, there's a paragraph at the bottom that says this, you know, this was maybe the second or third or fourth or fifth time that I read the book. Did Hank write it on his own, or were these dictation from Bill, or, you know, what was it? Was it exactly? So we really don't know who came up with those phrases, but we do know that it was what's in the on the original manuscript was written, handwritten by Hank and approved by Bill for inclusion in the story. But that's, again, me connecting dots that aren't there, you know, to say that Hank actually wrote it. Bill Schaberg says, late in my research, I stumbled across a letter Hank wrote 17 days before the book came out saying, Bill, you've got to make these changes. If you don't, I'll form a committee and we'll make them for you. So that was a big power play. Bill didn't really want to, he kept saying he wanted to change, and he kept asking, you know, Dr. Bob for criticism, and that he never got it. He wasn't all that wild to change it anyway. And so the 100 men who argued about the book in AA meetings didn't happen. It did happen with Hank Parkhurst and in the office with Fitzmayo and Bill and you know, a few silent people talking about it, but not the way that I had always heard that it happened before, you know. So a lot of these things and details, and some important, were just not the way I'd heard it before. It's amazing how recalcitrant and negative Akron and Cleveland were. This surprised me how little that Akron had to do with it. Jim Scott was sent by Dr. Bob to go have coffee with the members and get them to tell their stories. And Jim goes home and writes their stories. So they didn't write. They didn't all write their own. You know. But anyway, more has been revealed, and we found out that Jim wasn't the only one who wrote stories out there. There may be a new footnote in the second edition, Bob K. You know, there may be another footnote. Anyway, Bill and Bob, their relationship is co-founders. First of all, it's important to note that in early 1938, Dr. Bob Smith was not yet recognized by anyone as the co-founder of AA. The earliest discoverable instance of that term being applied to him is in 1947 program of the 12th anniversary. Actually, the fact that AA considers itself as having a co-founder is interesting. And everybody knows that Dr. Bob's a co-founder. Now, what is all this about, Nothing came out. And so I, immediately in a search for the truth, not to find fault or error or to prove a point, but I went out and I started, I found out that the phrase founding fathers in the U.S. wasn't created until, 100 years afterwards. And this idea of Dr. Bob not being a co-founder, well, again, people are always trying to come along and put things into my open mind. But this time, I mean, this is just, just absolutely going too far. I mean, Dr. Bob not being a co-founder. I mean, who ever heard of anything like that? Everything I'd ever heard, and Bill Wilson said it, and it's all in our literature about the co-founders. So this is just a little too much. There's something called the illusory truth effect. That's the tendency to believe that a statement is true if it is easier to process or if it has been stated multiple times, regardless of its actual veracity. So, again, in the interest of truth and science and I immediately went to my search engines, and here's one from 1947 is the earliest discoverable, so I found in the Grapevine in October 44, it says the co-founders, and here's a 1945 one that talks about our co-founders, and I went looking through old newspapers to find references to our founders, and in the Cleveland Bulletin, not to prove what I believe to be right, of course, but just in a search for the truth. And so finding all of these things, and I will mention, by the way, that when I or anyone else have found something, it has been eagerly and greatly accepted as new information. But, I know what I believe most of us protect our confirmation bias instead of attempting to get past. Our brain builds a worldview like it builds a house. If a new idea doesn't fit, it can destroy the whole house. Your brain protects you by not letting the new idea into the house, and then it builds an impenetrable fence and moat for further protection. My confirmation bias can make me progressively dumber. I hear something I don't believe in, I don't like, I don't, okay, well, I don't like what he said, so I don't like him, but, I'm going to do my own research on the real truth, and so I go to Google, and of course, the first link I found agrees with me, with what I already believe, so jackpot. I mean, here it is, jackpot, in the interest of truth, not trying to prove anyone wrong or anything, but just in the search for. And then I find another link that says Kearney Kurtz says some people are going to shoot me, but Dr. Bob isn't really a co-founder of AA. So here's another historian, and then I find Glenn Chestnut saying pretty much the same thing. Ernie Kurtz again says the truth will not always be what we want to find. The historian seeks the truth knowing that he or she will never find it. It is easy to feel that when we have a truth, that we have the truth. Historically, truth should be presented tentatively. How often when we think we've found a bit of truth, we've got to promote it. Our task is not to convince, our task is to present, and that's all we can do. We try to convince there's something wrong. We might have to present more clearly, but our job is to make available what we have learned. I liked the information on there is a solution. How the evolution from what was written in June of 1938, in there is a solution, the word religious appeared 13 times and the word spiritual never. By the time the book was published in April of 39, Religious appeared only seven times, and spiritual had replaced religious seven times. So there was a kind of movement and an evolution, a change of things from what was originally done to what was actually going on. Another thing that surprised me a lot was, you know, I certainly can't prove this, but, you know, I think that possibly there were more non-alcoholics who influenced the writing, the creation, the publishing, the editing, the marketing of the big book. Maybe there were more non-alcoholic friends that helped us do that than actual alcoholics who participated in those activities. I don't know, but they sure helped us out a lot. This was kind of a big surprise to me to learn about, especially some of these editors and Gene Exman and Dr. Richards and Tom Wiesel and some of these people. One thing that really got to me was Fitz's story, how it changed from May of 1938. In May of 1938, when it was first written, we have Fitz one evening playing a bridge with two other alcoholics and a drug addict. And a man comes to him to try and see, he said, to get him sober. And he said, are you willing to live up to being to the four absolutes, being absolute honest, absolutely pure? You know, can you live by the four absolutes? Well, by the time the manuscript comes out in February, we got rid of the drug addict. And there were now four alcoholics playing bridge. And instead of the four absolutes, he asked me if I believed in a power greater than myself, like God, Allah, Confucius. And then he asked me if I'm willing to write all the wrong restitution. And am I willing to be honest with myself and think of other people instead of myself? So much more what was happening in the time than what probably really happened in October of 1935, when Fitz got sober. But this was 39, and how things have changed. And so they regularly change the story so that it better reflects the present reality. Again, this is copies of Bill's presentations that are on YouTube that anyone can have access to. And rather than accurately reporting what actually happened. Again, memory frequently remembers what the present wants to hear. And then about the six-step program, I mean, this is one that, I mean, I've been telling people this, you know, passing this message along for years, you know, and now it comes along. Well, the first record I can find of Bill Wilson ever telling the story was in May of 1949. All right. Gave me another target and try to, you know, prove that something that I believe is wrong. So I went and I found a letter in the GSO archives from 1947, you know, where Bill there at the end of the little blurb there says, prior to the book, we had, you see, a word of mouth program that included, say, six steps. So again, just in my search for knowledge and not trying to prove anything wrong anyway, just in a search for truth. That's why I do all these things, not to prove that what I believe is right. Of course, if there had been a six-step program, it would have been mentioned by Frank Amos or in Fitz's story, the earliest version, which it wasn't. And in the stories, in the 30 stories in the big book. And of course, the steps aren't mentioned. No six-step program in the stories in the first edition of the big book. And of course, there's Earl's story. Talks about the six-step program at the time. Complete deflation, dependence, and guidance from a higher power. Remember those two phrases. Complete deflation and dependence and guidance from a higher power. So anyway, Earl's story was written 18 years after the fact. You know, I already know that already learned that Fitz's story changed in 6 months from what it was like to in 1935 to what it was really like in 39. So, you know, this was written, Earl's story was 18 years later, and we really don't know who wrote Earl's story. We do know that Bill recorded a lot of stories for the second edition to the Big Book, and then later he and Tom Powers edited them. But it sure sounds like memory remembering what the present wants to hear. And, you know, it just, even Ernie Kurtz says that the formulation of these six steps was contrived by Wilson. And Glenn Chestnut, the same thing. No evidence that there was any formal six steps. Well, you know, wow. I mean, I've been telling this story for years, and all of a sudden, the evidence seems to be against. Now, let's talk about strange bedfellows. I somehow can't imagine Dick B. Kenby and Bill Schaberg in bed together. Well, you know what I mean. Strange bedfellows. But even Dick B. agrees that this so-called six steps didn't exist. And he says the language simply that Earl used was simply not the language employed by Dr. Bob. Complete deflation. I mean, that's a Bill Wilson, William James phrase. Yeah, well, not really there, but it was a Bill Wilson phrase. And this higher power, you know, Dr. Bob, you know, is never quoted as using a higher power in his writings and talking. He talked about Heavenly Father and God and the Lord. And later on, neither Earl nor his wife, they both lived a long time, ever in any interviews made any mention of six steps. So, you know, this story I've been telling for all these years maybe doesn't seem to be true. And this six-step thing is probably one of the biggest kerfuffles that still goes on. I mean, people either believe it or they don't believe it, you know, and you start arguing with some people and you know, you get angry and everything else. But this is one that is different from our hallowed stories. And facts just really don't like that review we told. Well, this may be factual, but it's disturbing. And facts, as John Adams put it, are stubborn things, but our minds are even more stubborn. You know, and again, our confirmation bias, we have our beliefs, and new facts and evidence, you know, we search for and interpret and remember information that confirms what we already believe. And that's tough. You know, facts and beliefs are different, and perspective has something to do with the two. Some people are looking at things from different points of view, connecting the dots differently. Facts and beliefs are different, you know. If you're on a desert island and you see a boat, you're happy because there's a boat. And if you're on a boat, you're happy there's land. You know, there are different perspectives. And of course, then there's presentism. This is a term used in historical analysis to describe the introduction of modern ideas and perspectives into interpretations of the past. And presentism prevents objective understanding of history. It inserts bias. It's looking at the past through the eyes of the present. You know, it's looking at 1939 with 2024 eyes, culture, learning, and it prevents objective understanding of history and inserts bias into our analysis when we should remain impartial. It applies modern ideas when they did not exist then. Like, I get questions all the time about, you know, how did Dr. Bob take people through the steps, you know, and just a lot of other things. And in presentism can be used to support modern or historical beliefs, you know, like, well, it was June 10th that Dr. Bob's last drink and the first 100 and the six steps, whatever it is, you know, it all goes back to memory frequently remembering what the present wants to hear. And of course, we can believe what we choose. We do our own. We're answerable, of course, for what we choose to believe. You know, if believing in the six steps story, you know, has kept you sober and you still believe in it no matter what, well, a great Bostonian historian says that if you still believe the six step story, you won't have to change your sobriety date. It's okay. You can still believe that, and we'll consider you sober. You know, William White talks about history. There's no ideal approach, as each person will approach their investigations from their own perspective. My beliefs about the history of AA continue to evolve, sometimes dramatically. All writings on the subject come from the author's perspective, but the key to this work is finding the original material, the best evidence we can access, and then document those sources. Down there at the bottom, the few A historians take offense when proved wrong. I have never had any example taking offense, and things are not proved wrong. They're just more things are revealed that we didn't know before. The goal is to confirm what really happened as clearly as available evidence will allow. I asked Bill to give me a few words for this presentation. And what he said was, when Sarah and I were looking on this book, working on this book, we never really considered what impact it might have, other than a likely negative response from Akron. But after 5 years, I'm pleased to say that in general, readers have given me nothing but the most glowing reviews. There have certainly been some negative comments, see those Amazon reviews, but they rarely come to me directly. I suspect it's those 416 informational footnotes and 1,570 citational endnotes that severely limits the number of viable challenges to the challenging the creation myths aspect of my book. But this is not to say that there haven't been some successful challenges. More has certainly been revealed in the past 5 years. We can only hope that this story will continue to be clarified as it gets closer and closer to what really happened, the historian's primary goal. Truly, the most amazing and completely unexpected result of writing the big book has been dozens and dozens of 20 plus years sober people who have told me that reading it has completely rejuvenated their program of recovery. Gotta love that. Bill Schaberg ends his book by saying, most important is the fact that since the big book was published in early 1939, the big book has shown millions of people a precise and proven path to continuous sobriety through a spiritual awakening, allowing them to live sane, fulfilling, and fruitful lives without alcohol. We have no idea how many millions of recoveries have been affected by Alcoholics Anonymous since the book was published, but if an exact number were known, it would be staggering. AA currently reports the fellowship has well over 2,100,000 sober and active members. It was the writing and publication of the big book, more than anything else, that made all of that possible. And I'm going to paraphrase those two paragraphs to say that most important, however, is the fact that since I first flew up to New Jersey for the book launch in November of 2019 to get my signed copy of the big writing, the big book, I have purchased the Audible version for commuting and the Kindle version for learning, researching, and sharing the well-documented information, detailed historical documents, and yes, even the connecting the dots sections. And we have also been reading the book together with Q&A sessions with Bill since then. We have no idea how many recoveries have been affected by writing the big book, The Creation of AA, since it was published. But I do know that often, in spite of myself, I've been able to have a deeper and wider understanding of those 18 months of early AA when the big book was being written, the message was being shared, and lives were being saved. The fledgling society was charting a course for me, for us, for the next 90 years and further into the foreseeable and unforeseeable future. Bill Wilson, thank you for our story. Bill Schaberg, thank you for our history.
Wow, Jim Worley, that is incredible. Please unmute yourselves. That's
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you,
That's
Jim.
great work.
Excellent job, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, great job.
Jim.
Changed my life. Work on your humor a little bit.
Good. Outstanding.
Thank you. Thank you all. I do want to just mention, you know, briefly that, you know, this is, it is a book that has changed a lot of AA thinking and in history because of its deep dive of research. Yeah, it's 900 some pages, you know, and there are things that maybe not everybody wants to read, but it's in there if we want it, you know, and the information, you know, has been so helpful to AA and to me personally to feel more a part of what was going on. And there we go. Bill began researching in September of 2007, writing July 24th, 2010, finished the first draft on July 24th, 2017, polished and edited for over a year, published on November 5th, and signed my book on November 16th, 2019.
Jim Worley. Oh, look who's in the house.
There he is.
Bill Sherberg. We're going straight to Bill Sherberg. Bill, would you like to come in?
Thank you, David. And more important, thank you, Jim. I just, you know, there's so much historical stuff going on Zoom that I just never have time to make time for it. And but I made time for this one. You know, we postponed dinner an hour and a half from our regular time so that this could be happening today. And originally we had people scheduled for dinner tonight, and I wasn't going to be able to make it. And I was like, God damn it, I want to hear Jim do this thing because it sounds really, really good. And I got to tell you, I had to do a couple of quick screen capture shots on some of those early mentions of the co-founders. So you and I need to talk about some of those before that I haven't seen. Those are just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stuff. And I just can't thank you enough for the fabulous work that you've done and the way that you've helped me get this story a little bit closer and a little bit closer and a little bit closer. Just you are one of the outstanding people who have adopted the message we've been trying to say is, you know, you got to go back and look at the primary document resources or all that old stuff. It can't just be telling the same old stories again if in fact those documents contradict those stories. I mean, well, you can. I mean, I would still tell a newcomer the kitchen table story. I mean, what the hell? We're just trying to get the guy sober, you know, and the message is in that story that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic is how the message gets passed. So why wouldn't I be telling them that story? I don't have to get into the messy details that Ebby goes into. Anyhow, I do have to run for dinner, but Jim, thank you. Thank you very, very much. I really, really appreciate it. You're an outstanding historian. You're an outstanding Alcoholics Anonymous member, and you've been an outstanding friend to me over the last several years. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill.
Bill, we're back reading Bill's new book tomorrow. If you want to get more information on that, Robert put it into chat. 30 Things, Practical Advice for Living Well. Oh, that's great to have that. We're going to stop the recording there, and we're going to go through, I'm going to set it up again for the Q&A. Let's just keep that fresh.